Hi everyone, my name is Makani Temba. I actually am a colleague of Lakshmi's, and we are splitting the presentation, but just a little bit, because Lakshmi did the bulk of the work, and so I'm going to set my little timer, because I'm not going to go more than about 3 minutes. So our presentation, or really Lakshmi's presentation, which I'm supporting, we don't have any relationships to disclose. That are important to this, is about how immigration, right, is a health justice issue, and most importantly, about how the immigration policy is a health justice issue, right? And so part of what we want to talk about here is really, and I know folks have been talking about this here at Socialist Caucus and also in 1848 about embodied health. Right. So some of this is about the history of what people carry in their bodies and the trauma, right, of migration, because we have militarized borders, the trauma of what it means to be dislocated, the histories that are about race and racism, but mostly about racism in terms of, oh, and look at that. It says my time. That was so fast, right? Let's go. And how racism shapes immigration policy, right? So why do we have militarized borders on the South and not in the North? And also, why is it that folks get to be able to sell products without borders? That is the push, right? In fact, when you try to sell your product and you want to have a tariff, that's considered bad for capitalism. But if you want to sell your labor and cross borders to do that, you know, that's considered a negative. That's criminalized, depending on where you're from. So all of those are part of how we begin to think about what is immigration, what does it mean, what does the trauma look like. But immigration policy, it also in terms of what even is a border, and is a matter of history and geography that often isn't taken into account. And as public health folks, we often step into this conversation talking about immigrants as simply workers, right? And so part of what we want to do in this conversation is go beyond thinking about immigrants as workers and think about the whole history, think about how these histories shape how we think about the work and the policy. And oftentimes people get confused because they think of immigration as simply a matter of the motion of human beings, as opposed to thinking about these three things together. Because if you don't understand how the economy works, you don't understand how geography is a political project, and you don't understand racism, then you can't understand immigration policy, and you can't understand its health impacts. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lakshmi.
So thank you, Makani. She was very humble and did not mention that she is both the founder and executive director of the Praxis Project and has published extensively on local communities making policy change as well as racial justice communication. So thanks for laying that out. I'll shift over to our next slide. So why does immigration matter for public health? The dominant immigration narrative is that an already challenging pathway to citizenship can only be possible if there is heightened border militarization. And so we see this juxtaposition of, you know, we will grant citizenship rights if there's increased militarization along the border. But the actual economic incentives for securing a labor force that is actually what's fueling the immigration debate becomes marginalized within the mainstream discourse. And a lot of this is largely due to, or can be attributed to, how the media frames the issue. And because of that, the result is that a host of worker health and safety protections associated with the labor force, which include wage theft, refusal to pay overtime, illegal paycheck deductions, unsafe conditions, and union busting, all have heightened public health consequences, specifically for immigrant workers. And that becomes sidelined and completely left out of the discussion, although there are several groups that are working on centralizing this as part of the analysis and sort of the accompanying conditions. And one of these groups is CATA in New Jersey, which is a farm worker support committee who's doing a great work on this. Additionally, disagreement and disparities in health care for employees is actually the leading cause of worker strikes, as Drs. Carlos Montaner and Vicente Navarro point out in their work. And this is within the context of 1 million people losing their health benefits coverage every year in our country. And lastly, immigrants are overrepresented in the industries with the weakest labor protections, which has historically and continues to be farm workers and domestic workers. And 46% of domestic workers and 42% of farm workers are immigrants. And we'll see that in the next slide, distribution. So in this chart, which is from a report from the Brookings Institute, we've circled the two industries you can see on the end over there, agriculture and private households or domestic work. And according to this graph and a report from the Domestic Workers Alliance, which was put out earlier this year, just under 50% of domestic workers are immigrants. And the agriculture industry, although here it looks like less than even 30%, a lot of folks in that industry have undocumented status, and so that accounts for a lot of why they're not represented here in this graph, and we'll see that in the next slide. But one thing of note here is that although you know, categories like infotech and high-tech manufacturing that you can see kind of towards the middle there can be misleading because there is a lot of low-wage work involved in those industries that are not necessarily represented in here. So the next slide here shows sort of the legal status of hired crop farm workers, and for the latest year that they had data from the National Agriculture Workers Survey, 2009, and you can see that just under 40% of folks have some type of unauthorized status, which makes them further vulnerable to exploitation. So what's at stake? As with most racial and social inequities, there is precedent. In the mid-1930s, most black workers in the southern states were engaged in either farm labor or domestic work. And excluding these sectors from the protections of the National Labor Relations Act ensured that southern black workers could not form unions. And this is sort of the basis of the report that the Domestic Worker Alliance put out this year. It's called Home Economics, the Invisible and Unregulated World of Domestic Work. And I encourage folks to check out that report. And today, these same industries with high percentages of immigrant workers and workers of color continue to deny their workers basic protections under key federal legislation. And some of these include components of collective bargaining through the National Labor Relations Act, fair compensation through the Fair Labor Standards Act, and health and safety standards at the workplace through OSHA. So what are the consequences? In 2012, as you all can see, over 4,000 workers died on the job, and nearly 20% of those employees were foreign-born. California farm workers have 5 times the death rate of other employees because of their exposure to toxic chemicals, heat, and injury risk. 67% of live-in domestic workers are paid below the state minimum wage, and the median hourly wage of these workers is only $6.15 an hour. And undocumented immigrant workers are barred legally from seeking basic labor protections at the federal level because of the 2002 Hoffman Supreme Court ruling, which an undocumented immigrant sought to get back pay because when he was laid off for union activity. And so he was both criminalized for being a part of a union and also denied back pay because of the Supreme Court ruling, which still exists today. So here in this chart, just to give a visual about the value of the minimum wage and how it has steadily decreased, taking its sharpest sort of decrease in the 80s, which was the onset of neoliberal policies, and where you see a huge privatization of industry, which goes hand in hand with criminalization of unions. And that's a legacy that continues today. Senator Harkin and Representative Miller in the U.S. Congress have been trying to introduce minimum wage legislation for several sessions to increase it to $10.10 an hour nationally and then peg it to inflation after that. But the bill usually dies in committee, but they will be reintroducing it again, so hopefully we can get that. As we all know very well here, inequality is bad all around, but in particular, there's a lot of research out there that shows that inequality is both bad for the environment and for public health. Dr. James K. Boyce at UMass Amherst has produced significant research showing this. And neoliberal policies in the 1980s resulted in a steep decrease in labor share of profits, favoring lower wages, mechanization, and wider gaps in salaries between workers and CEOs. And this was also accompanied by a federal assault on public programs and social expenditures. And it's there that we begin to see the sharp rise in social and racial inequalities and the plummeting value in the minimum wage, which we just saw. And Dr. Boyce's research in power distribution, the environment, and public health has also shown that the psychological and social dimensions of inequality significantly increase the incidence of cancer, heart disease, and other illnesses. And as we all know, this is in highest prevalence in communities of color. So this OECD data shows sort of the correlation between social ills and economic inequality. And as you can see, the U.S. is at the very top for both, ranking the highest in income inequality in what have been deemed developed nations, and the worst for health and social problems. So this is should be a very heightened concern to all of us. So organizing as a tool for public health, and why is that an important intervention? With increased privatization and concentrations of profits and power and a vastly weakened public sector, collective bargaining has become increasingly challenging in the last decade in particular. So this makes organizing, especially at the local level, that much more critical for public health outcomes. And as such, organizing is an important and effective tool for public health, perhaps even more than some traditional interventions, if we are attempting to address the social determinants of health, which is becoming an increasingly important approach in the field. Organizing is effective as a public health intervention for two reasons. First, because of the change that it actually results in, and we'll get into organizing victories later in the presentation, but also because of the process itself, which Makani touched on. Connections between people builds resiliency, reduces risk, and creates agency, and that is actually what should be driving and shaping policy and resulting in better health outcomes. And most importantly, organizing doesn't prescribe a narrative about the problem and solution from the onset, but actually creates those by those who are affected by the problems. And when it's done right, it shifts power, and it identifies and challenges relationships of class, race, gender, and sexuality. And in doing that, you end up getting to the root causes of many of the outcomes that we're seeing. So just to continue in organizing as a tool for public health, again, Drs. Navarro and Montaner, in their book, define health promotion at the workplace to include health and safety at work, influence over job conditions, working hours, wages, stable job contracts, and social security issues. Makani actually has written and organized extensively about how effective health promotion strategies surface the intersections between these issues and comprise multicultural, local, and geographically community-centered coalitions to ensure long-term environmental and policy change for healthy communities. And coalitions with workers, academics, scientists, practitioners, and labor and health administrators have historically been instrumental in health promotion. And Drs. Montaner and Navarro actually list several examples. One of those, which I'll touch on, in Denmark, the cooperation workers, academics, and the action group workers, academics, produced more than 80 reports, pamphlets, and materials covering industrial and other parts of working life. And most of these projects were initiated by single workers or shop stewards who got support from their local unions, investigated the problems they saw with students and professionals, and their reports influenced working conditions around the country and eventually forced the paint industry to reduce threshold limit values for organic solvents and develop and use water-based paints. So that's just one example. And these examples here are actually all participatory action research, where the research problems are being defined by those who are most at risk. So quickly, just to go over some of the organizing victories that are incidentally all from this year, starting with the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, which was just passed in California this year, but in the last few years, it was the third state. New York and Hawaii had already passed bills previously, and this is thanks to the tremendous organizing work of the Domestic Workers Alliance based in New York. And in addition to several of the rights, one of the things that domestic workers will now be eligible for is overtime pay for working more than 9 hours a day. And one other associated victory with this at the federal level is that in 2015, the Fair Labor Standards Act will actually include domestic workers, so they can be covered under minimum wage and overtime legislation. Many of you have probably heard about the minimum wage legislation that passed in New York State and also the paid sick days legislation that passed in the city earlier this year. The only thing is that doesn't include tipped workers, so that's another campaign that's still going on to include them. The Senate bills in California, the first of which would ban California employers from hiring foreign workers brought to the U.S. by labor contractors who are not registered. And the key thing here is that this will actually allow the commission to determine which contractors are violating workers' rights. And in the second one, it would level fines up to $10,000 and revoke operating licenses from businesses caught threatening to turn in workers because of their immigration status. So as we can see, at the federal level, there are still a lot of gaps in the current and proposed legislation. In particular, as we all know, the immigration bill that is on the table, we don't know what's going on with it, still leaves many people ineligible for worker protections. And then even with ACA implementation, as difficult as that has been getting started, even when that is fully implemented, 30 million people are still going to remain uninsured. And as mentioned before, there's still no federal minimum wage legislation. So there are some very serious gaps and that have very serious public health consequences. So in conclusion, thinking about what transformation might look like, so even outside of policy change, what are the conditions that actually create transformation? And some of the things that we think about at Praxis is these things listed here, and as it relates to the public health field, public health contributing to building shared power and governance, looking globally for best practices and model policies, advancing justice values in its pedagogy and practice, undergirding people-centered and transformative ideas with research and data to create a stronger voice for change, helping build institutions that adopt radical ethics and values as their guiding principles, and strengthening the public sector. So just to think about how to sort of evaluate the change that we want to see, these are some of the ways in which we can evaluate, looking at how much policies and change are building power and agency, looking at how much we're expanding network and capacity in communities, changing structural conditions, shifting the public discourse, which involves strategic communications and how that's echoed throughout the field and outside, and increasing equitable resource distribution and support. And so we hope this can help some thinking in the public health field to be part of a new discourse that centers the economic and racial determinants of immigration and the public health consequences of that, and then really adopt organizing as a central intervention strategy to address these issues, because we feel it is our responsibility to do so. So thank you.